This podcast is part of the Shareable Podcast Network. Learn more at shareable.fm. Hello, friend. I'm Jeff Gibbard, and this is my podcast, Shareable. I decided to call it Shareable because the conversations I have with my guests are so good, you got to tell someone about it. Shareable is a variety show of sorts where we talk about culture, relationships, leadership, dating, business, comics, marketing, art, sales, and more. Wherever the conversation takes us, one thing is for sure, this podcast is Shareable. Welcome back, Shareable. I'm your host, Jeff Gibbard, as always. And today with me, I have author of the book, Forging an Ironclad Brand, A Leader's Guide, Lindsay Peterson. Lindsay, welcome to the episode.
Thanks, Jeff. It's good to be here with you.
Yeah, I am so totally jazzed to be talking to you today. I spent the entire morning with you, as I alluded to prior to us, you know, officially jumping on the episode, reading through your book and going through the different concepts in there. And I have like within the first like three chapters of it, I think I built enough notes in front of me that we could do like a marathon of like 10 episodes.
Because okay, I'm down with that.
I honestly like, and I say this. Not suggesting that people do this, but I think if people just went through your book and read the headings, like literally that's it, like without even reading all the stuff in between it, it would be a masterclass. And then if they were to do what they should do, which is read all of the stuff under the headings, I think that they would get so much out of it. Your book is so, it takes theoretical kind of ideas and makes them like ridiculously concrete. You are so very specific in it. And I'm so glad to have you on because of that. Because I know that you are really, I don't want to say like you're not against, you're just sort of the antidote to the squishy, elusive, and superficial and intangible kind of idea of brand. And I think people look for that. So I'm super stoked to have you here.
Well, I'm really super stoked to be talking with you about it. And that's such a compliment that you gave me about my book. I invite people to just skim the headings and see if that alone either whets their appetite to read more, or it's like, oh, now I get these things that I have been wanting to get.
Yeah. I'd imagine it should, like, if, you know, again, like listeners, if you see Forging an Ironclad Brand on a shelf, just pick it up and like leaf through it a little bit. Because really what I got before I start any book, I'll read through the chapter headings. I'll kind of like process the book rather than read it. I'll start by like kind of seeing what's the format, how's it laid out, you know, headings, all that sort of stuff, chapters, what's the flow of it. And just even through that, I got like really excited to start actually reading through it. Because I really do think we have this problem in brand, and you really describe it beautifully. I think it's even in the first chapter, you're talking about how when you left the Bay Area to move to Seattle and you started, you know, your brand strategy agency, you had these interactions that will sound very familiar to anyone who has ever encountered anyone that does anything in brand, where people would say things to you like along the lines of like, so you do logos. Oh, I love graphic design. Or we don't do brand because we market with SEO. And it's like, I think that's the issue. You mentioned something really brilliant in there that you alluded to this interview that Malcolm Gladwell had, where he talked about when people talk about brand, he likens it to when people say Africa. And I thought that was a really interesting analogy. Are you able to go through that? By the way, I'm talking really fast now, but I read your book this morning. So, and it's really like on the tip of my tongue, and I realize you probably wrote it before this morning. So if I bring up anything, you're like, I don't even remember what I wrote. That happens a lot. But so it's really close to me. But if you remember that part, what did you mean by that?
I do. Yes. So Malcolm Gladwell, somebody asked him this question in an interview, a podcast interview about brand. And he said, you know, I get kind of uncomfortable when people ask me about brand. And the reason is I feel the same way about the word brand as I feel about the word Africa. Like, what do you mean? If you're talking about Africa, you could be talking about, that's a big old continent with, you know, wildly varying problems and terrain and even climate. So if one person says Africa and they mean, you know, the slums of Johannesburg, and the listener is picturing Morocco or the Maasai tribes outside of Nairobi, it's going to be a really confusing conversation. And the same sorts of things happen with brand. So I say brand and one person thinks of a logo, another person thinks of TV advertising, another person thinks of kind of the personality and tonality of a business, another person thinks of a tagline. All of these are expressions of brand. So it's not that they're wrong. That's what makes this sort of tricky. It's just that brand is a very large and important and highly consequential word, just like Africa is. So it's so important whenever I have a conversation about brand now, I know to make sure we're defining the term so that when I talk about it the way that I think of it, the listener is, you know, hearing me the way that I want to be understood.
So talk to me about that and kind of explain for people then, what do you mean by brand? And yes. One of the things that I really like, and I'm sure it'll come up in, is this concept of the North Star. So talk to me a little bit how you would explain it in a simple term, like give me your elevator pitch real quick, and then we'll dig deeper into it. What is brand?
Brand is what you stand for. It's the meaning that you own inside the brain of your target audience. So, you know, that what that implies is all businesses have a brand, whether they are deliberate in defining it as I advocate folks to be, or whether they are passively just letting the market define it for them. So it's what do you mean? It's this relationship between your business and the audience of your business. How is it that they think of your business? And that will be the sum total of all of their experiences with hearing from or interacting with your business. It's not just one thing. It's not just your messaging. It's certainly not just your tagline or your name or your logo. It's everything that you mean as in their head as a result of all of the things that they experience of what you do. And so when you think of it that way, and if you believe that that is beneficial to be deliberate in defining what you want to stand for, then you can see how it would be kind of weird to think of brand as merely a logo, because as a consumer, and you can think in your own life, like, are there any businesses that you're really loyal to because of their logo? Likely not. So, but if you think, what are the businesses, what are the drivers of my loyalty to a given business? It's what they give me. It's the value that they provide for me, which comes through in their product. It comes through in, certainly comes through in their messaging. It comes through in the way that I feel having interacted with that business. So it's much easier to just kind of like check the box. Yes, we have a logo, we have a brand, but it's not going to give you all that much value as a leader in making decisions on how to come to market and how to allocate resources. So when you believe that it's you're well served to do it in a deliberate way, then you define what you do want to stand for, and you allow that meaning that you want to stand for to be your North Star. And that North Star informs everything that the customer experiences, not just marketing, not just your copy. It's actually also informs the culture that you're building. It informs your hiring. It informs who do you bring on? How do you retain them? How do you make them excited? What are the new products? What are the innovation roadmap ideas that you want to adhere to? What are the how do you want to price it? How do you want to evolve your pricing? All of these things that are way more upstream than your marketing, those are the things that add up to what you're going to mean inside the head of your audience.
When you describe it that way, it does feel really big. And when you have people say things like, oh, you do logos, I feel like it's people trying to simplify that, because, you know, as you go through the book, as you go through really, you know, any good book on brand, there's a lot of deep questions that have to be answered to be able to create this North Star. You can't just like create a North Star in an afternoon unless you're super clear on like who you are, who you serve, how you want your company to grow and develop, and all those other things that kind of are born out of brand. So it's a really big and complex topic. Do you think that because it's so big, that's why people try to boil it down, that brand marketing is this, you know, it's your logo, it's your colors, your fonts, or
yes,
it's,
I do know, think that's
your tagline?
Yeah, I think it's a nebulous, it's big, it's messy, it is nebulous. And some people, I mean, it's interesting because there are people who don't mind that. And actually, especially in the creative world, I think that a creative audience is actually okay with that squishiness. What I find with my business, though, I work with CEOs, and I haven't met a CEO yet who likes squishiness. So it's really easy to see how somebody might, somebody who does not like squishiness and has only experienced the idea of brand as a squishy one, to dismiss it, or to tidily tuck it away into marketing or outsource it to an agency, instead of owning it and considering it their most durable competitive advantage. So that was my kind of the bee in my bonnet, and what motivated me to write this book was to deconstruct it for people who otherwise would find it either mystical or intimidating or both, because it's worth understanding. It's so powerful. It makes your life as a leader so much more successful and satisfying and fulfilling when you do have that North Star. So I have a lot of heart for bringing this idea of brand as a North Star to the people who I think most benefit from understanding it in that way.
So I want to put a pin in that and come right back to it, but I need some clarifying context about you, where you come from with this. So there are people in brand who are of that kind of creative background, and the only thing they really care about in the brand is all of the squishiness, right? And that's who they cater their brand conversations for. Then there are brand marketers who come from, you know, the CFO type background. Like, for them, brand is a function in which to deliver tangible business, numerical, measurable value to the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And then there's sort of every kind of space in between. In reading you, it seems like you've got a healthy balance of those two. But I want to understand where, you know, your kind of, your genesis of this came from. Like, before you ever got into business, like, how did you even decide, yeah, I want to go into brand? How did you perceive business? Like, what for you is the driving purpose and force behind why you do this? Is it so that you can bring those two things together? Is it so that you can deliver, you know, tangible monetary value? Is it so that you can make business more human and connected? Like, what's your thing?
Yes, all of those.
Again,
oh yeah, gosh, right? It's so, this is welcome to my therapy session, everybody, because it's so when you think back and you try to like retrace, like, how did I get here? It's not a straight line, at least in my case.
Good, let's follow the squiggle then. Talk to me.
Okay, the squiggle. So I spent my undergraduate career thinking I was going to become a clinical psychologist. And so I went very deep on working with people in, you know, people with psychiatric conditions. And that was my plan. I wanted to, I really loved kind of understanding the psyche. But then my senior year of college, I realized, well, that actually means being in academia for like 7 or 8 years. And that isn't really, I'm kind of a practical person. I didn't really like that ivory tower element. And so I was sort of floundering and started working in a role where I was doing, I went into management consulting. It's probably the shorter way of saying it. I started doing management consulting with Deloitte, where it's kind of a great thing to do if you don't know what you want to do, because there's such a broad cross-section of industries and functions. So sometimes it's like optimizing call centers, and sometimes it's, developing processes for a healthcare company. But it was It was really good for me, kind of like taking vitamins, but it was not something that I enjoyed. And so in this program that I was in at Deloitte, you have to either go to business school at the end of it or just leave the company. So I went to business school, and when I was in business school, almost the first week, I think I took my first marketing class. And so here's me. So I'm a liberal arts background person. I was a psychology major and an English minor. And I started taking marketing and I was like, holy cow, this is just psychology applied to an economic entity. And my second favorite class was economics, microeconomics, game theory, behavioral economics. So that's when it was a little bit of a eureka that you could have a career doing that. And so that was my interest in marketing. I continued to, I got a general MBA, but I took a lot of marketing classes and I did my internship between the 2 years at Clorox, where I was in brand management. And then I went back to Clorox after I finished business school, and I spent 6 years there in brand management. So tell me, Jeff, if I'm going too deep, if I'm like,
no, on here. The only thing I'll interject here is that our stories are remarkably similar. So I'm loving watching this from the outside.
Okay. Wow. That's so intriguing. So it's similarly squiggly.
Yeah. Well, even the, where the squiggles landed us. So we'll get to that in a moment.
Okay, good. I want to hear from
you. When you tell me kind of how you arrived here today, yeah, then I'll jump in and I'll give you my like 60 second, hey, wow, we have similar stories.
Okay, cool. Okay. So when I was a brand manager at Clorox, so in consumer packaged goods, Clorox, Nestle, Procter & Gamble, General Mills, Johnson & Johnson, the brand manager is the CEO of the business. So the brand manager actually has P&L responsibility. And so you're really truly a leader of a business, and you're not simply trying to get marketing metrics. You're trying to grow the P&L, and marketing is the primary way that you can do that, but it's a means to an end. And brand is very much considered sacred in consumer packaged goods. Like what your brand strategy is, this idea of North Star is very familiar in a consumer packaged goods world. So I got really good at defining brand strategy when I was in that environment, as all of my peers did. So when I left Clorox and started a consulting business where I was working with leaders on marketing strategy, I realized real quick that this was unique to consumer packaged goods, that brand was like the North Star of the business. And that's when I started getting this bee in my bonnet to change that and share with others that brand can be this really this filtering mechanism for building an intentional business.
Got it. Okay, so here's my 60 second.
Awesome.
So I wanted to be a professional basketball player. That didn't work out. I wanted to be a filmmaker. That didn't work out. I wanted to be a photographer. Then I started a personal chef business. Everything was about like me doing this big, amazing, bold thing where I was going to be, you know, a Hall of Famer and whatever it was going to be. A lot of creativity, not a lot of business savvy. Decided to go back to school, and that's when I got my MBA. So my undergraduate was in film and media arts. So it was very much about communications. I always had an interest in psychology and people and relationships. It was around that time that I read How to Win Friends and Influence People, changed my absolute world. And I became very, very fascinated with the idea of persuasion and influence and, you know, connection. And I've always felt that like my friendships and relationships and network were always like my strongest thing. So I go back to school, I go to business school, and I don't know what your experience was like in business school, because I'm not sure quite how similar our kind of pre-business school was. I know you were liberal arts and psychology, but for me, when I got there, it was like jumping into an ice bath because nothing felt right. I saw, you know, the first half of my business school was finance and accounting. And I was like, what the hell is going on? This is not interesting. And it's terrifying because I hate numbers. I'm also not a super hardcore capitalist. So like, you know, people are talking about like selling companies and this and that. And I'm like, I don't care. Does anybody care about like the people at these companies? So anyway, I get to my second half of the MBA and I take some marketing classes and I'm like, okay, this is cool. And then I take organizational behavior. And I'm like, this is amazing. And I learned basically three big lessons throughout my entire MBA. Everything else I could kind of consider is like, you know, just little things. But the big things were money is a language of business. Economics matters in everything. Even though I wasn't great at econ, I found it to be incredibly fascinating, very thought-provoking, why people make decisions, the theories of supply and demand, comparative advantage, all that stuff was like killer, totally awesome. And then the third thing is that everyone has a role, because the big thing I learned was not every business person is going to be good at the same thing. So I have my strengths. There was a point where like they had to have, we had to give, break up into groups and give a presentation. And all the people that had been helping me with accounting and finance all of a sudden were like catatonic the way that I was when I had to calculate net present value. And I jumped on stage and did my presentation. They were like, how in the world did you do that? So everybody has a role. So that's me coming out of that. I go to a management consulting firm. I was there for about 2 years doing interactive marketing, digital marketing. Went to a PR firm, left, did my own thing, started my own company, sold my company after 7 years, was at the new agency for a year and a half, and now I'm here. So in a lot of ways, kind of similar patterns. We have like an idea of why we went into it, kind of went back to business school, kind of better synthesizing all these things together. And now we can work with businesses from a, kind of a balanced, measured perspective.
I love that. Yes, we are kindred spirits, Jeff.
Yeah. Okay. So I put the pin in it. I want to come back to it now because this is... Your story makes this question for me that much more interesting because I struggle with something similar. To me, what I see one of the issues with brand, and this is a similar thing with any, I do a lot, you know, my thing has been strategy for the last 12 years. So I work with companies to try and figure out how do you take, you know, goals, timeline, budget, and audience, and then build a strategy around it so you can get what you need with your marketing objectives. And the problem that I typically see, and it's probably a little bit, it's easier for me in my work with marketing than it would be, I think, for brand, is that I see that a lot of brand is not a quantifiable thing. It's not a thing that you can put on a spreadsheet and compile it. And to your point, CEOs don't like squishy. And if you can't, you can measure a brand effect after the fact. You can kind of look at like certain brand metrics. But a lot of the work that you have in this book, the questions that are asked, you cannot put them in a spreadsheet. So I guess the question is, how do you go about doing this work or even convincing the CEOs that you work with to do this work when you can't process the work to get to that brand strategy in a purely quantitative and numerical way?
Yes. Yes. This is something I think about a lot.
It's exhausting, isn't it? I find it exhausting.
It is. And it's made exacerbated by the confusingness of the word brand. So there's two ways that I encourage leaders to think about this. Number one is brand strategy. So separate brand strategy from brand marketing tactics, brand awareness building tactics. They're two different things. So the brand strategy is the exercise of defining who you want to be in the world. And that doesn't cost anything necessarily. It could cost you the time that it takes you to do it if you engage an expert to help you with it. It costs that money, but it's not a media spend. Brand awareness building tactics are a media spend, and like any marketing expenditure, should be measured for ROI. So first of all, kind of disconnect those two things. And with the brand strategy part of this, it's closer to just business strategy. What's your goal as a business, and what is your unique right to exist in this market, in this the world of your customer? Because if you can't be super duper clear about what your unique value is, you can't really expect your customer to. So it's like think about it almost more from a philosophical standpoint. are you building a business that you want to endure for a long time and mean a lot to a lot of people? If no, and by the way, that's a valid response. If you're, you know, building an arbitrage kind of flip company that you want to quickly exit, you know, sell to a competitor, maybe you don't need to build, maybe you don't need a deliberate brand strategy. If you want to be around for a long time, and this is in a way, this is how I personally suss out the types of leaders that I want to work with. If you want to be around for a long time and to build something that really means something beyond the P&L, then your brand strategy is probably the most pragmatic tool that you have to accomplish that. So that's brand strategy. Now, brand marketing, when people say, I can't measure brand, what they usually mean is it's hard for me to see the effectiveness of the money that I spend on brand awareness. You know, the billboards that I put up or the TV ads or the radio ads or, sponsorships and events. It's really hard for me to see the effectiveness of that. Okay, so what I now we're kind of out of the realm of brand strategy and we're into the realm of marketing ROI. I do believe that you should be able to measure media spend. Anything that you spend money on on a regular basis, you should know how effective it is. But to say that you can't measure brand awareness tactics or media spend is, I don't believe that. You can. Now, can you measure it in the next 24 hours? No. And it's much, you know, you can measure lead gen and, you know, most performance marketing tactics, you can measure almost in real time. So no, you can't do that. But again, are you building an enduring business or are you building a business that you're going to flip in 3 months? If you're building a business that you want to be around for a long time, then you probably have time to measure the effectiveness of your brand awareness building tactics. Ultimately, and sometimes this is where the more kind of CFO-minded CEOs perk up, ultimately, brand awareness building is going to help your CAC, the cost of your customer acquisition will go down if you have an integrated, thoughtful marketing mix. So you're touching people with awareness, you're touching people with consideration, and you're doing lead gen and performance marketing. In the same way that somebody who's going to propose marriage has a higher probability of getting a yes if it's the 10th date than the first date, the same thing happens with customers because trust is building during that process. So your CAC is going to go down when you're doing, if you're doing successful brand awareness building tactics, your CAC is going to go down. Here's the final thing, and I think this is probably the most value creating. Customer lifetime value. If you are super clear on who you're serving, what promise you're bringing them, and how they're ultimately better off because they interacted with your business, because they bought from your business or they spent time with your business. When you do that, you decrease price sensitivity among your customers. So what's the economic argument for brand? It elevates your pricing power. It makes people not care as much what you charge, right? Like ultimately, that is what defines how much your business thrives is your margins. So if you are, by definition, preferred brands will confer higher price than non-preferred brands. So you're going to make more money when you are on brand. And that translates to the lifetime value of your customer. Compounding that is that brand also fosters loyalty. So not only do they have a higher willingness to pay one time, but they will stay with you over longer periods of time. So you can, that's where it really becomes a multiplier for a business from a P&L standpoint. It's not just about reducing inefficiency in marketing, which you get by cutting the cost of customer acquisition, which is really a really important and worthy thing to do. But if you want to be around for a long time, you want to have customers that are going to be with you for a long time as well, and customers that value you way beyond the price or the cost of the goods that you're selling.
So much there to unpack. Okay, so first of all, I want to state for the record that I'm a believer. So I firmly believe in brand as a bigger concept than logos and brand awareness metrics and marketing. And I think everything that you just said there, I think does a really good job of encapsulating why brand marketing tactics are in fact measurable and part of a larger overall marketing system. I want to hit the reverse button though and go back to the brand strategy piece. And I want to take the position of devil's advocate's not the right word, because that's not actually, I'm not challenging out of a, what I want to do is I want to say, in my experience, I found certain people that will challenge from their own perspective, right? So the CEOs and executives that I've worked with, sometimes there's been a little bit of a need to convert them and turn them into believers at the very beginning. And what you just described, going from brand to brand marketing strategy, I see there as kind of being like two different things. And I think that you did the second thing first there. And I want to go back to the first one, which is that I think when you're going through those conversations where you say a brand is what you stand for, a brand is a relationship, a brand is a promise and a fulfillment of that promise. So if we take that and we say, yes, we agree with that, and we're believers in that, then we can go to that next step and talk about the brand awareness, marketing tactics, and how you measure that, et cetera. But what if you can't get people to buy in that previous thing? Because if you can't get the brand set in the first place, because they're questioning, well, what is the value of finding out, like, so a brand is a relationship. What does that even mean? Relationship is so squishy, right? Like, brand is what you stand for. Well, we stand for making more money. How have you dealt with, because there are the, and maybe the answer for you specifically is, those aren't the clients I work with, because that just sounds like a pain in the ass, which it is. But I want to go back to that because I think that the problem that brand has in my viewpoint, in my experience, has been you have to first convert them to believers. They first have to understand that it matters that you have a promise, that you have to convert them to the idea that it matters that your customer will have a relationship with you, that the shorthand that they will then occupy in their brain for what your brand represents to them makes their buying decisions easier in the long run, that it removes the friction for them because they understand the promise that you've made and you've fulfilled it and they trust you now. But you first have to get them to believe it. So when you're sitting there in those rooms with the executives around the room and you're saying, okay, so who do you want to be in this world? And you get blank stares back at you. How do you deal with that? How do you get them to believe in the first place that brand matters?
Yes. I mean, the very pragmatic first response is I don't work with people who are only who are mercenary. You know, like I'm doing this right?
I want to make the money.
Yeah, it just doesn't, because actually, and it's not so much a judgment as it's a mismatch. Potentially, there are businesses that have created massive value without having a strong brand, because they have had other competitive advantages. So like Microsoft, not the coolest brand, wildly value creating company, right? So it's not like, it's not coming from the only way that you can thrive is by having brand, but you have to like maybe, so then I come at it from, if it's somebody who I just really want to see it this way, and this is also why I wrote this book, is there is so much to deconstruct. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll say, like, forget about the word brand. You know, if that like has baggage for you and you just like are allergic to that word, what's your competitive advantage? Because I think that most leaders would agree that you have to have a competitive advantage to win.
That's a good doorway.
It's like a definition. Like it's like the definition, right? Like if you can't win without a competitive advantage, whether it's military strategy, IP strategy, business strategy, or brand strategy, you need to have an asymmetrical advantage over the rest of the market. So sometimes that helps, because, and by the way, it's the same you know, whether we call it competitive advantage, whether we call it brand strategy, sometimes people prefer to call it the mission, whatever, you know, like I'm not like a purist so that you have to use the words brand strategy. But sometimes that will help. Like this is really another one is business strategy. What's our business strategy? Well, business strategy always articulates how are we going to win? How are we going to win? How are we going to accomplish this this goal that we have set out? Well, the way that you accomplish that is by having a competitive advantage. And the way that you have an enduring competitive advantage is to have a brand, because it's very easy to copy most things. It's easy to copy features. It's, you know, patents expire eventually, but it's very difficult to copy emotional benefits. It's very difficult to show up as a character that another business already shows up as. So that's how it becomes this sustainable competitive advantage that otherwise you can't have. Sometimes that helps them. But the people who are haters like that, in some ways, that's why I wrote this book, is to say, hey, it's okay that you don't like squishy. I don't really like squishy either. This actually isn't a squishy concept. Elevating pricing power, fostering retention, you know, building a competitive moat, those are all economic concepts. They're not squishy at all, and you can put numbers to them.
Yeah, and I would just re-endorse that. I think your book does a really good job specifically for skeptics and haters or non-believers, because I think you do a really good job, again, of tying that kind of squishier idea, those concepts that feel more touchy-feely and human, and translating into why that actually becomes monetary value for the company. So kind of going back to that, the way that I tend to perceive brand, and this is in part from a conversation that I had with a good friend of mine who's starting a brand agency named Q Xavier. He was on episode 104 of Shareable, and he had this really interesting model of describing brand, where he described it as essentially, on the one side, picture that you have business, and on the other side, you have people, humans, right? Brand is that thing that sits in between, that sort of translates the business to the humans and the humans to the business. The brand is how businesses can understand the needs and wants and everything of the humans, whereas the humans can use brand to better understand who is, what is, what's the promise of the business. So it's this thing that kind of sits in between. And in my mind, brand typically is, if it had to choose one of those two masters, it would choose humans, right? That the brand is for serving and understanding the needs of the humans, guiding the humans towards understanding what the business is about and the people inside the business of what the business is about. So brand is very much about humans. And it seems to me that brand is a commitment to something. And business is a commitment to profitability, to reducing expenses, to increasing revenue, and ultimately driving shareholder value, at least in the current state of this economy. Do you feel that there's a morality or an ethics to brand, that because it involves humans, it is what gives business the warmth to better understand its role in this world outside of just making money?
Yeah. I love this frame. Okay, so there's the moral. Okay, so let me parse this.
Yeah.
I think that you can have a really great brand and not be a woke company. Okay, like I don't think that they necessarily have to coexist. But I think the larger question, because without getting too like philosophical about what right is and what moral is, I go back to, and you said this, businesses exist to serve a customer, to create and keep a customer. That's what I believe. That's the Peter Drucker. That's the definition of a business. A business exists to create and retain customers. And the side benefit of that is that it creates financial value. Okay.
That's now, interesting. That's how you define
it. Yeah. Well, and I mean,
maybe I'm just pessimistic.
I'm certainly just one person saying that, you know, I mean, well, I'm not just one person because Peter Drucker was no, you know, he was not a lone voice in the woods.
Yeah. He's a leader in the field. So he definitely, right. I had never read that definition. I do think that it feels a lot nicer than the way that I tend to think about it.
Well, so if you go to, and you can, I think you can still be moral neutral here. So a business exists to serve a customer. How does a business serve a customer? Well, it identifies something that customer needs that nobody else is serving, and it finds a way to solve that need. That's value. That's value creation. And when a business does that, and does so with its eye toward we exist so that we can create value for this customer by solving this problem that they have in a way that nobody else can solve it. That's a highly empathetic way of looking at your business, but it's also the way of running your business that will create the most economic value. So they go hand in hand. Why? Because the value exchange, so a business makes money because customers give money to the business. If you're going to ask your customer for their money, or, you know, in some businesses for their time or for their attention, but let's just say money, you're asking them to part with their hard-earned money for something that you're giving them. So make sure that thing that you're giving them is worthy of that money you're asking for. That you're bringing huge value to that person so that you deserve the money that they're giving to you. And when you do that, they will love you more, which will decrease their price sensitivity and increase their loyalty, which allows you to have this flywheel of value creation. So I think that, you know, like, I think that the moral kind of layer to this is almost more like frosting. Like, you still can have, you can still create a really thriving business if, as long as you're bringing value to your customers, you're creating value for your business. And if you're not doing that, then you're not going to be in business. Your customers will tell you through their inaction that you don't deserve to exist as a company and you won't be a business anymore. So that's kind of that's the way I think about it, because I'm thinking about it. I have worked with businesses that are not woke businesses. I don't think I've ever worked with an immoral company, but most companies out there are not, you know, like Patagonia. Although that is a business that I massively admire and would love to work with someday. But a lot of businesses are like, you know, the yoga studio down the street, or, you know, the franchise of coffee shops in, I don't know, Eastern Washington. And they're trying to, you know, they're trying to have a livelihood. And in order to do that, they have to create something that's of enough value that people are going to part with their hard-earned money and give it to them. And so I guess I'm a little bit less lofty about it. Now, having said that, if you are going to have a woke brand, one that is really going to stand for something that's hugely meaningful in a large scale, like Patagonia, you can't do that without bringing value to your customer. So just because you have a woke marketing campaign like Gillette, doesn't mean like that's a function of what you're saying out there, but it's much more important what you're doing. What's the experience that the customer has of buying that razor? So I think that they can be really mutually reinforcing. But I think that brand is so fundamental to a healthy business that it exists outside of morals.
I totally agree with that. I think the example of Gillette is like a really interesting one, especially when compared with something like Patagonia, because in the in the brand of Gillette, all that stuff isn't exactly core to the function of who they are and have always been. Whereas with Patagonia, it's they are who they say they are, and they always have been that way. So it's like you can't even get away with having a brand like Patagonia without having done all of that work of who you are in the world, because there's so much. It's like in the book, you give an example of Volvo, how like you say Volvo and everyone thinks the exact same word, safety, right? Everybody thinks that. And with Patagonia, they have built a brand in which they are known for what they are known for who they are. And whereas Gillette, it's like they're known for their brilliant razor blade strategy of, you know, disambiguating the handle from the actual razor blade. So I think that's a really good example. I do want to talk about price sensitivity, because it's a thing that came up in your book, and I kind of want to poke at you a little bit with it and see what you think.
Good. Poke away.
Cool. So, and I want to put out there before I even get into this little set of questions is that whenever I consult with individuals, one of the things that I tell almost everyone is like to raise their prices. And I first give them all the reasons why they can, like all the things they have to do in order to be able to raise their prices. But I'm a big fan of raising your prices, because value in our economy is a function of what people will pay. So you push the supply and demand curve until it breaks. So you should charge the maximum you can possibly charge by delivering the amount of value that is required to be able to charge that. I personally believe that. That said, I think there's a question here about what value actually means, because there's a lot of different ways to define value. And you give an example in your book that I think is a really interesting one for us to tinker with. So I'm gonna put it out there. So in the book, you talk about Clorox. And you mention how Clorox, as bleach, is essentially the same ingredients as any other bleach, but it costs more. And the reason why is for all of these things that happen with the brand of Clorox. And it's this kind of perceived value. It's the emotional benefit that comes from it. And I think it's very difficult for us to put a dollar value on a perceived benefit, an emotional benefit, something that is not tangible, related to the value of the product in almost like a Marxist sense of like value is the creation, the labor that is put into, you know, like a raw utility, right? So if Clorox has the exact same ingredients as other bleach, brand is what allows you to increase the value of that. I guess the question is, one, is it ethical to use a brand story in order to increase the value of a product that has kind of a set market value based on like a commodity? I mean, I guess that would be the first place for us to start.
Yeah, yes. I've thought about this a lot, and I hear you.
And again, I tell people to raise their prices all the time. So like, I'm not saying like you shouldn't charge and make as much money as you can. We all got to eat. But I guess I'm looking at like when you look at the fundamentals of what you're delivering, you know, how much of that is real, tangible, actual value? Like, here's the amount of wood that went into this, and here's the output based on labor, and here's the cost. How much of that actually gets passed along to the company in terms of profit versus the value that gets passed back to the customer because the company was able to reduce their cost of goods?
Right. I think that the first principle that's relevant here is target audience. To your target audience, when you're crystal clear on the kind of the center of the bullseye of the person that you're serving, you're pricing according to their value perception. So it's interesting, whenever we have this discussion, and I had a lot with my peers at Clorox as well when I was working at Clorox many, 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 many years ago, that Clorox bleach, so 6% sodium hypochlorite, 94% water, and it is the same contents as a store label bleach, and yet the price, we price it much higher. When somebody makes the kind of pushback that you just made, it's universally somebody who is not the target audience. And the reason I think that's relevant is to the audience for Clorox bleach, they actually, they massively value the non-tangible benefit of seeing a Clorox label in their laundry room. Now, that might not describe you or me or a lot of people that I know, but to the people who we are optimizing our brand for, they really care about that. So they would be a little bit insulted if they heard that the perceptual benefit as opposed to the concrete functional rational benefit of bleach, they'd be a little bit insulted if you told them that that's not a real benefit, because they actually care a lot. They care a lot about kind of the feeling that they have. It harkens them to childhood. It makes them feel like a good mom. Those things are worth paying for to them. Now, as soon as you start to like, it breaks down if you're not really, really high integrity about who your audience is, because then the people who are not the target audience, who don't value it in that way, are, first, they're just not going to buy it, frankly. And so what a really disciplined leader does in the face of something like this is they say, what does our target audience value? Not what does everybody value? What does our target audience value? And they make pricing decisions accordingly. So that's almost, Clorox bleach is like a stylized example because it's so extreme. But most businesses, it's not literally a commodity like that. Let's talk about Volvo for a second. So Volvo, they could charge more than they do, but they don't. And the reason is they're optimizing their price for their target audience. It's all congruent. So they're, all of the signals that the consumer perceives about the brand are aligned to uphold the same meaning. And the customer wants to pay. The Volvos are more expensive than Toyotas. The customer wants it to be more expensive. So that's the way that I think about it. I realize though, it's really easy to kind of get into a slippery slope with that because you don't want to gouge your customer either. That would not be, Peter Drucker's maxim to get and serve customers. That would not be serving the customer either. So I think you can take this too far. But I do think maybe like the main thing that I hope people understand when listening to this is that price is another way that customer experiences your business. So allow your price to be an expression of your brand, just like everything else. And don't assume that having a low price is better for your customer. That might sound kind of weird to say, but if a Mercedes customer walked into a Mercedes dealership and found that Mercedes are suddenly $10,000 instead of $70,000, I think they'd be really annoyed and would find that they don't like the brand as much anymore. So make pricing decisions, just like all decisions, according to who your target audience is, not to who you are. Because if you're not the target audience, you have to like step into the shoes of your customer and then make that call according to how they perceive it.
And so much of this, I'd imagine, is a function of the culture, like the big C culture, not like company culture, but more like the culture of the society that we live in. The more that we see celebrities carrying around Louis Vuitton bags, the more people want those. And if Louis Vuitton were to take their bags and reduce the price of them, that's no longer the signal of wealth and opulence that it once was, to your example. I guess I just always kind of get concerned with it, and to your point about like kind of the slippery slope of it. One thing I do want to dig into on that was you talked about target audience, and it's a thing that I wanted to get really deep into with you, because a lot of the questions that I tend to get about brand are things that undoubtedly people listening right now think, and undoubtedly all of the people that you have probably ever worked with think, and it is the question of how do you choose? Because so often we think, oh, well, you know, a great example is like Clorox bleach again, or Volvo, or any of these is like, well, everybody needs bleach in their house, or everybody needs a car. Well, how do we choose who? And you give some really good frameworks for picking your target audience. And there are a lot of other questions that I want to get into with you at some point about kind of the who decides and how do you pick sort of thing. But let's talk about target audiences. When you sit down with a brand and you want to be able to have this conversation with them, because we've gone through a lot of territory here. You want them to, they now understand they need a brand strategy. That brand strategy is going to inform their culture. It's going to inform their sales team, their brand marketing tactics, their, all of this is going to come together. And they say, okay, now we need to get started. Let's pick our target audience. And you say, who's your target audience? And they go, everybody. So how do you start walking them through this?
That happens all the time. Everybody. Yeah. I'm building my brand
and I'm like, I don't have any idea how to say no, because I just want everyone to have this, you know, like, how do you do it?
Okay. So first of all, like sometimes, when you ask yourself or a leader the question, who's the target customer, it kind of sparks this fear that we're not going to be able to sell to people who don't fall into this group, into this target audience. So the first thing that I tend to say, which alleviates some anxiety, is target audience is not the same as total addressable market. So, you know, on the dartboard, the total addressable market is everybody that could possibly buy what you're selling. That's a big circle. And then the target audience is simply the center of the bullseye. So just because we're saying that we're targeting moms with kids at home, like Clorox, doesn't mean that, you know, if you're a dad, that you're not allowed to buy Clorox bleach, right? Like, we're just saying that we're going to optimize for the center. So yeah. That's the first thing. And that alone.
Can you give the REI example?
Yes.
The REI example was like, so this conversation of target audience, there's actually two things I want to make sure that we talk through. And the one is, I think you did nicely, which was the dartboard example. I thought that was really, really a good visual example of it. But your REI story of it, I think, crystallizes that. So if you could share that with the audience, that'd be awesome.
Sure. So REI, outdoor gear company, their target customer is the outdoor enthusiast. This is the person who brings the most value to REI because they spend the most money on outdoor equipment, and they also are the person that receives the most value from REI. So it's this reciprocity between the customer and the brand. So the outdoor enthusiast, that's the target audience. So if REI were to say, so I, Lindsay, walk into an REI and I camp a maximum of 3 times a year, and at least 2 of those 3 times are in my backyard with my kids. If REI were to start optimizing for me as their target audience, Lindsay, who is like not much of an outdoor enthusiast, they would start losing the outdoor enthusiasts. And this is where it gets really interesting, they would also start losing me. Because the reason that I'm going to REI is that the outdoor enthusiasts shop at REI. They know what they're doing. So I'm going to trust them. So as soon as REI kind of waters down their target audience to get, because there's probably more people that camp in their backyard than that like hike in the Cascade Mountains or in Nepal. As soon as they water that down, they lose both. So instead, and this is sort of the marriage of the dartboard analogy and REI, instead think of it as the outdoor enthusiasts are at the bullseye on the dartboard. I, Lindsay, am one of the outer circles of the dartboard. But when you shoot at a dartboard and you shoot for the center, you're more likely to get on the dartboard at all. And you're by over-serving the outdoor enthusiast, you're more likely to bring in somebody like me as a customer as well. So you're best serving everybody on that dartboard by over-serving the middle of that dartboard.
Love it. Love it. So that was the first thing I wanted to make sure we covered. The second thing, and this is, I don't know if you're willing to do this, but like I said, I'm dealing with this with my brand right now as I left my agency back in July and I'm starting a new thing and I keep trying to figure this part of it out. And
let's honestly, do it.
So when I read your book, you have this thing about picking your target audience. And candidly, like, I've been through the pick your target audience conversation with clients for the last 10 years. And I gotta say, you framed it in a way that I hadn't really considered. I think I've probably brought it up time to time, but like, I don't think I've ever considered it in the same way that I have. Like, when I think about target audience, when I talk about clients, I'm typically saying like, okay, so you serve, you know, women between the ages, because I'm thinking of it almost like a Facebook advertiser, right? Like, so you serve women between the ages of like between 35 and 45 who live in a major metropolitan city and have one kid and who, you know, watch X show or this or that or the other thing. So like, it's very demographic heavy, but then there's also the, you know, technographics that I'm thinking, how do they use tools? How do they use technology? All that. And then you think about psychographics, you know, what are they interested in? What are their kind of behaviors and different things like that? But there's something that you brought into the mix that I thought was like a really interesting piece of it. So I'd like you to first set that up, which is this kind of, what's a shared value or theme that you as the brand have with the customer? And that really resonated with me because of the type of work I'm trying to do. But talk about that a little bit, about this, the several different ways that you can define a target audience.
Yes. Okay. So the most basic way that I ask this is, who's the person you want more of? Tell me about that person. Who is, what are they like? What matters to them? What are their behaviors? What's their level of involvement with your category? How often do they shop with you? How much do they spend with you? Tell me about this person. And what do we know about them? What is their, why do they buy us? Why are they involved in this category? That becomes your target audience is who do you want more of? And the reason that you want more of them is they bring the most value to you. Now, you as a company can independently decide what you mean by value, because some companies might be like, who's the highest price, the person who spends the most with us. That might be the marker for a desirable customer with one company. Whereas maybe somebody who has very low churn, high retention, might be for somebody else. And then, you know, if in a nonprofit environment, it might have nothing to do with money. It might have something to do with how much they overlap with your mission. This is the type of person that I want to work with. So that's the, all it really is this question of who are the customers that you most want and how can we, serve them best so that we can attract more people like that. So that's the really like fundamental question here. So if you do have a kind of a mission driven lens, Jeff, it sounds like you would be in this camp. Then our Patagonia would be another company like this. Actually, REI is as well. Many nonprofits would be. So if you're a company that you're really like your goal, that the customer that I want more of is the customer who's going to enable me to attain this mission more effectively. And in a lot of cases, the way that you achieve that overlap is by looking at what their values are. So what they care about. Now, sometimes that value is very behavioral. So actually the REI example would be that somebody who spends a lot of their weekends in the outdoors. That's a behavioral overlap of values. REI has a dual mission. Actually, they're trying to get more people to enjoy the outdoors more and to take care of the earth. So that person is actually not only bringing them more financial value, they're also bringing them more mission value. Now, above the functional level or the behavioral level of spends a lot of time outdoors, it might be this is a person who cares very deeply about what we as a company care deeply about. Everlane is a fashion brand that is very much about transparency of the supply chain. Like, how did you get this silk blouse? What factory made it, and what were the workers paid who made this blouse? This is a brand that I personally am very loyal to because I care a lot about that. And they're serving somebody who has an overlapping value, because that's what they care about as a company. That's why they started the company. That's another way in, another lens to help you get at this idea of target audience. One thing that you brought up, Jeff, is demographic markers. So this is a really common thing for people to conflate. When you're defining your brand, your brand positioning, what do you want to own inside the mind of your audience? You're looking at the psychographic, the most like, who is this person? What motivates them? That's how you define your target audience. When you're in a moment where you're about to buy media, so you're about to buy Facebook ads, you're about to buy outdoor ads, then you're starting to, you by necessity need to identify some demographic markers in order to reach those people. But don't confuse those two things. Start with, when you're defining your brand, start with who is it that you want to serve really disproportionately. And then when it comes to a media buy, then you can turn to, oh, it turns out that outdoor enthusiasts, if you're REI, tend to live in, urban areas, and they tend to consume a lot of NPR, and they tend to be upper middle class, and they tend to be, 60% male, 40% female, something like that. Those are interesting, pragmatic ways that you can reach them, but don't confuse the tail of the dog with the head of the dog. They're not going camping because they're male and live in an urban area. They're going camping because they care about camping, and it just so happens that they also live in an urban area and are male.
Yeah, so it's like, don't define the center of that dartboard by the demographics, define it by the values and like the underlying unifying who these people are based upon the thing that they share across any possible demographic.
Yes, at least when doing the brand strategy. I think when you're doing a marketing campaign, if you're doing if you have a specific tactic in mind, say it's Volvo, and they're doing since I live in Seattle, they're doing a Pacific Northwest promotion, then they are going to start layering in demographic regional markers in order to reach me. But that's different from saying, oh, we're going to redefine the Volvo brand to optimize for people who live in Seattle. No, that's like, so you can start to bring in demographic markers, but don't do that until you're at the tactical media buy level.
Love it. Love it. So, when I think about my own thing, there's a number of issues that come together. So I'm going to kind of lay a couple things out here, but, when it's a brand of one, it's a lot easier to answer the question of who decides, because it's me. But I think what a lot of brands will have the trouble with is that there's a lot of different cooks in the kitchen. So let's say you have multiple owners or partners. They're going to have different ideas of what that brand is. So before you can even do a brand strategy, you have to get, alignment internally. Or maybe there's the issue of, well, is it just the partners that get to decide, or is it also the team that gets to decide? But what about the customers? The customers decide what your brand is. So I guess the question is, who defines what the brand is? Is it, more than one? So when you're entering into that brand strategy phase, is it a collaborative sort of process, or is it something where there needs to be somebody where the buck stops with them? So I guess that's kind of a starting point. I guess when I think about my own stuff, I have trouble choosing, but that's just a me problem. A more difficult problem is when you start adding multiple constituents into the process. And I know I need to consider who my customer is going to be and all that, and who they are and what their values are. I need to do all that too, but it's got to be a lot more difficult when you have multiple competing points of view. So I guess the question is, who decides what the brand is?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm probably different from other brand strategists in this way. I require the CEO to be in the project with me and to be the client. And the reason is, I think it's disingenuous to build a brand strategy without the CEO being the one to make the call on the tough trade-offs. So And the subtitle of my book is A Leader's Guide. So it's Forging an Ironclad Brand, A Leader's Guide. And the reason is that it is so common for leaders to delegate brand to marketing. But actually, in order to give air cover to marketing as well as to the rest of your teams, you have to be the one who can model it. So ultimately, just like with any strategy, it's a decision about what you're, when you decide on what you're going to focus on, you are inherently also deciding what you're not going to focus on. And you're taking things off the table so that you can focus on this singular thing. And the person who the bucks, whoever owns the P&L, so if it's the CEO, sometimes it's a P&L owner or a general manager, whoever owns the P&L needs to be the one making these decisions, or they will not be adhered to once you're implementing the brand. When push comes to shove and you have to make a hard decision, one is on brand and one is off brand, but the off brand one is the one that will yield the most fruit in the next couple of weeks. If the CEO wasn't making, CEO or the P&L owner wasn't making the tough decisions while building the brand strategy, I guarantee they're going to go for the what's off brand, but is going to generate utility really quickly. So it's ultimately a very courageous act to make these choices. And it takes a lot of humility to answer with honesty and curiosity and empathy. Who are the people who we most serve? And what is it that we best bring them that nobody else brings them? It takes courage to define that and to not hedge. And therefore, it not only takes the leader to be doing it, it takes a leader who's got the courage to do this. Without that courage, you might build a good brand, but you're not going to build a great brand.
Yeah, I completely agree with all of that. So now the next question becomes clarity, which isn't a question, it's a statement. So I'll clarify what I mean. By the way, great branding on adding a leader's guide, because that really does position who you're for.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So look, some people have branding superpowers. Clearly you do. It works for you and you're able to clearly communicate. Other people are going to find it much more difficult to articulate the answers to the questions that you're posing here. So you put together Forging an Ironclad Brand, a leader's guide. You know who you're for. And that's a very short form, to the point. You know, it's just beautiful. It's who it's for, right? It's exactly what you do and who it's for. But a lot of people have trouble in articulating what it is that they do, who they're for, et cetera. Is there a secret sauce to simplifying what your brand is about, or a framework? There's a lot of things that I do with clients where, like, if I'm teaching them how to pitch, I have a couple different frameworks. There's one I use called ABC, awful, better, connector. You describe the awful world that exists before your product, then the better world that exists, and then you're the connector, right? So it's an easy way to pitch your product, like in a pinch, you need to figure out how to differentiate yourself. This is how you do it, right? So that's a framework that I use. I use frameworks for customer service, for all these different things. I have shorthands. I have frameworks and, you know, kind of templated kind of ideas in my head of how to do these things. And as I'm going through my process of trying to just, like, I know instinctually who I want to serve and what I want to do. It's a lot of different things, but putting it into a clear and simple way of doing it proves very difficult. And I've been going through Donald Miller's story brand, and I'm reading books like yours, trying to figure out how to do all of this. And I've yet to uncover any sort of, for lack of a better and more cringeworthy phrase, silver bullet. So how do you go about doing it and working? Because without you, how, or someone like you, how do brands do this where they answer all of these questions, then they're still left holding paragraphs of text that no one's ever going to get through to understand what their brand promise is? How do you do it?
Yes, totally. So when I decided to write this book, what I realized fairly early on is I want to demystify brand, but I also want to show a sequential method for building it for people who are not comfortable with squishy. So you haven't gotten to it yet in my book, but the probably this like the second half of the book is an 8-step method that I use when I'm building a brand strategy for clients. The way that I just my own style, I like to follow a process. And I think partly it is because when this is already an amorphous topic brand, it lends it, it's such a relief to have some, to be able to put some structure to it. So the step-by-step process that I use, that my business uses when working with companies, that's what I kind of unveil in my book. And the first, we've already talked about the first step, which is defining your target audience, defining your competitive frame of reference, like who you compete with. And then the second step is to listen. But let me talk about the third step, where I have, because I, like you, Jeff, I love frameworks, because especially with something that it's hard to get to clarity when you have this like visible structure container that you can put it in. It's so helpful. So there's a Venn diagram that I use. I call it the uncommon denominator. And so there's three circles. There's your customer. What does your customer want? So you like list the things that your customer wants. And there's another circle in the Venn diagram is your competitive strength. So what is your competitor good at? And by the way, by competitor, I don't just mean direct competitors. I also mean substitutes. And what are the workaround solutions? What is the behavior there that you're competing with?
I'm glad you added that, by the way.
Very competitor important. Is
really important to clarify that.
Really important. It's what is the consumer view as your competitor is what we're really asking here. Not like,
I would like to add nothing. So like there's always the option of doing nothing. And when I say that to people, they're like, huh? Like,
yes,
they don't have to buy from me or my competitor. Like, no, sometimes they can literally just not do anything.
That's probably the majority of the volume that most businesses source is from nothing. It's from non-consumption. So like when I was running Clorox Bleach Pen, which is like this controlled form of bleach gel, the competitor was living with stained shirts, because you couldn't, either throwing away, giving them to the Goodwill, or just living with stains on your shirts. That was our main competitor.
It's a powerful thing. As somebody who spills a lot of stuff on my shirt, I now have like the desire to pause and go to Amazon to order myself some Clorox pens.
I would love it if you did that, Jeff. So first circle, what does the customer want? Second circle, what is the competitor good at? What's good about that competitive behavior from the customer's vantage point? And then third, what are your strengths as a company? What are you really good at that the customer cares about? What are your, you know, maybe it's intellectual property, maybe it's your product, maybe it's your culture. What are the things where you really, really shine? And when you view it through the lens of this Venn diagram, you notice, like within any Venn diagram, the center of the three circles, what something that the customer wants, that the competitor is good at giving, and that is also your strength. So you're good at it, the competitor is good at it, and the customer wants it. Great. But here's the thing. Most people, when defining their brand, stop at that. And the problem is that is not an ownable benefit, because it falls into the circle of something that your competitor is good at too. So pancakes, I'll use the example of pancakes. So what does the customer want? They want like a lovely Saturday morning with their kids. They want something that's easy to cook. They want something that's delicious. They want something that's a little bit out of the ordinary. What is the competitor good at? Well, Duncan Hines is really good at distribution. They're available everywhere. They have a very quick recipe. They have a lot of heritage and brand loyalty. And then what is my company good at? So I've got this Swedish pancake brand, and we have this proprietary recipe that my Swedish grandmother brought from Sweden. We've got this thin, crispy, texture to our pancakes. We use organic ingredients. You know, you list all these things. Well, okay. So in the very middle of the Venn diagram is delicious, right? Because your customer wants something delicious, your competitors bring something that's delicious, and your product is delicious. That's great, but you're a pancake. You should be delicious. That is table stakes.
Preach.
right? Right. Like, so that is, that's what most brands do, is they say, oh, we're the delicious one. It's great that you're delicious, but that's the beginning, not the end. That's where you have to go, okay, great. But what's the way that we show up that nobody else shows up? And yes, we're delicious, but we're delicious plus something else. So in my example of the Swedish pancakes, the something out of the ordinary, the customer wants that. And I can bring that because I have this really unusual Swedish recipe. So that becomes the uncommon denominator. So it's the overlap of what your customer wants, what you're good at bringing, at what your competitor is not good at bringing. So the Swedish extraordinary experience, that becomes your positioning. And of course you're delicious, but you're going to stop talking about delicious because that's a category benefit. And if all you talk about is being delicious, you're generating demand for the category, but not for your business in particular. So that's, I think that that's the main thing I would share from a framework standpoint is this Venn diagram. And you also, by the way, can look on my website if you don't have my book. And I share this Venn diagram. I've seen people print it out and show it to their CEO just to get the CEO to see that brand is not just a logo. It's what is the differentiated value that you bring to your market. And you can see that by, you know, through the sharp lines that surround these circles, you can see it.
Got it. Uncommon denominator.
Yes.
Because it's so, you know, I think about this because I remember walking by, I was in New York and I was on my way back to the bus and I walked past like, it was like Best Dry Cleaner. And I was like, what is that? It's like, what is that? Best Dry Cleaner. Like seriously, Best Dry, like that's what you've got. You've got Best Dry Cleaner. Like you're the absolute Best Dry Cleaner. And when you said delicious pancakes, that's all I could think of. I was like, that is literally how almost all marketing now sounds to me. And part of it is volume, right? Like I feel like we're in a space now where there's so much content and there's so many repeaters out there. There's so many people that are just basically clipboards. They just copy somebody's, you know, inspirational post and then they make it into an Instagram post and a tweet and whatever. And it's like we're diluting the meaning of words and we're putting so many of them out there that it feels like it's really difficult to carve out something that feels unique and different. And I think that's one of the big challenges in, even if you were to go through this sort of an exercise, one of the things that I'm struggling with at the moment is trying to figure out how to phrase it in such a way where it's, you're very intentional in the book about talking about being specific and not being like general and vague, which makes perfect sense, by the way. But it's so difficult sometimes to take a big idea and make it specific when it feels like it's this big, vague, general, nebulous concept. And that by narrowing it to something specific, it can be very, it can almost feel limiting. And then on top of that, when you have the vocabulary that you have access to, words like delicious, it feels so common. So it, you know, short of sitting down with a thesaurus and a brand strategist, it feels like it would be so difficult to do it. I have just a notepad full of different like, oh, maybe this is what I do, or maybe this is the tagline I put on the website. But it's such a difficult thing to do.
Okay. So I have a couple of thoughts on this. One is, so I want to come back to specificity in a second, but you're bringing up a common pitfall that I see is conflating the exercise of defining your brand with creating the copy to express your brand.
Those
exercises absolutely different. Otherwise you just get so overwhelmed, or you pick a piece of copy that's cute but doesn't express your differentiated competitive advantage.
So let me ask you this though about that real quick. Sorry to cut you off, but so I feel very confident in like the overarching brand, who my company is, what I'm out to accomplish, all of that. And I've got this big thing, right? Like it's massive. So then I'm on to that next step of like, okay, well, what's the first thing that people see on my website? What's that 2 to 3 sentence thing? Like, so at some point when you wrote this book, like you had the book and in it, it is like jam-packed, full of awesome, but you still had to put a cover on that book And I think that's where, and I agree with you because I've been in those exercises where it's like, okay, let's talk about our mission, vision, values, and goals. Let's talk about what our purpose is. Like literally, like our purpose, if we were to die tomorrow, what is the legacy we've left behind? Who are we? What do we matter for? Right. And it's like, okay, well, on the website, our tagline will be no. Like, let's back up. Let's go to the bigger thing and talk about the bigger thing. So I'm with you on that. I guess where I'm getting to is that I think great brands, great book covers do that thing where the few words, the few sentences allude to the whole thing, right? They talk about that whole big brand, though. The book that you have, the cover talks about what's inside of it, right? The tagline you have on your website that illustrates what your brand is about. That's like the art form that, like, this is where the rubber meets the road, right? Like all of the exercises of who's your target customer, the interviews, the writing down ideas, all of that different stuff leaves you with notes and notes and pages of stuff. And at some point you have to turn it into a thing. And it seems to me like the hard work happens in doing all of that research and work that leads up to it. But then the very tiny task that feels insurmountably larger is coming up with how to distill that down into a sentence.
Yeah. Or even a word, right? Like Volvos. Jeez. Is just one word.
Yeah.
oh God. Right. Okay. Let me offer another framework that I think will be helpful for this. And then maybe we can even go through what yours looks like. Okay. So the benefit ladder, after doing the uncommon denominator and you know, okay, this is the territory where we are both meaningful to the customer and unique. The benefit ladder, and you can kind of like play around with this idea. If you draw a ladder on a piece of paper and you've got like the bottom of the ladder is your functional benefits and the top of the ladder is your emotional benefits. Mm-hmm. And you write down all the things that you bring that are good. Like all the things that you bring this target audience that they will value, from the very rational, you know, product attributes at the bottom of the ladder to the more kind of grounded benefits in the middle of the ladder to the emotional rewards at the top of the ladder. And when you do that, you start to like see, oh, okay, so I have this like functional benefit. So say it's Nike. So a functional benefit is that their shoes are lightweight. Okay. Like that's kind of it's like a very like rational, a rational statement. Our shoes, you know, our soles weigh 4 ounces. So who cares about that functional benefit? Like why does that matter? Well, because then our shoes will be faster, will perform better in the race. Okay. Well, why is it good to perform well in the race and to be fast? Well, then you can win. So that's the top of the ladder. So Nike's positioning statement would be something like, to the athletes and all of us, Nike is the one shoe that will enable you to win. That's because Nike's shoes were created by the Oregon State track coach with 4 ounce soles. So that you will have your best performance and will achieve victory. I don't know, I'm making that up, but yeah. Something like that. Okay. So now you have your positioning statement. That's not a sexy piece of copy. Like you would never make that consumer facing language. But any copy that you ideate should lean into a portion of that statement. So in Nike's case, like up until I think it was 1989, when Just Do It became their tagline, it was mostly about speed, because that was sort of the middle of their benefit ladder. It was mostly about you can run faster. And then they became Just Do It, which is sort of this, you know, the moxie and swagger of winning, the top of the ladder. So what you say, your tagline, the headline on your website, there's no universal answer to it. It depends on where you are in your awareness building journey as a business, because Nike, you know, if they started out super emotional with Just Do It before anybody even knew what Nike was, they wouldn't be educating people that Nike is shoes, and they would lose people. So you have, they start with this more functional element and then build up. So first identify what your ladder is, what are your functional and emotional benefits, and how do they support each other? And then decide, where do I want to focus on this ladder based on where I am in my business building journey? So in my business, it's called Ironclad Brand Strategy. Brand strategy is the descriptor of the company, because when a company is looking, when a leader is looking for a brand strategy, they're going to type those keywords into Google, most likely. Whereas IDEO, the design firm, has such high awareness, or McKinsey has such high awareness, that they don't even have to say anything about like what they do. They can lean into the more kind of transcendent benefits. So that's another way of like getting a little bit less amorphous about it, is to build a hierarchy of where all of these things fit, and then decide where you want to live on that hierarchy.
I like that a lot, because as you were using your on the spot example of Nike, my thought was like, oh, well then I would probably put on the front page of the website for that, like lightness wins, right? Like You've boiled it all down. You gave me all different things. It's light. It helps you win all this. And I like this about the emotional and functional benefits, and then the features and attributes, and kind of, you know, listing them all out and then kind of jumbling them together until you find something that works. I think that is an excellent way of doing it. I like frameworks. That's nice.
Also, I mean, the thing is too, like, so that's helpful for copywriting, because I love that what you just did just in the moment just now, like when it gets framed, you can create on strategy copy more easily when you've gotten it distilled like that. But the other reason that these can be so powerful is way beyond marketing. If Nike knows that it's about speed, it's going to become a filter for their innovation pipeline, right? They could be evaluating, I don't know, like if it's the 1980s before they had climbed the ladder to Just Do It, and they were evaluating like golf shoes. Are golf shoes fast? No. Okay, then we're not going to do golf shoes. You know, it becomes a filter for things way beyond copy, because it's like a pillar that upholds the bigger meaning, the bigger promise that you bring and fulfill.
I like that, but it actually leads to where I was going to kind of take you next and ask you about, is that what happens when, you know, so you gave a really good example. I'm going to stay with that. So Nike makes golf shoes. They have great golf products now, but it wouldn't fit under speed.
Yeah.
So let's pretend that we're back in the 80s and they made basketball shoes, and they made running sneakers, and they made golf and tennis equipment. And they've got shorts and they've got sneakers. So now they do all of these different things. And even when I feel like with Nike, it's pretty, because of the exercise we just did, it's kind of easy to see like who their target audience is. But when describing who they are as a company, I guess as I'm even saying it out loud, I guess I'm seeing how like you can actually tie all of those things together once you actually have who you are as a brand.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're bringing up a really interesting dynamic that happens when companies grow beyond their original category. So, you know, Nike used to be in the shoe business, so it was fast compared to other shoes. When they decided to expand beyond shoes, and then they even expanded beyond running shoes to other types of shoes and sports, and even, you know, apparel for other sports. Well, first of all, part of the reason that they were able to do that, so like going back to the benefit ladder, the top of the ladder is victory, winning. You know, Nike is the goddess of victory. That's their emotional end reward. By making speed and performance an enabler of victory, and then they start to stand for victory, that enables them to cross categories. That's another reason to have a benefit ladder, because you can see victory doesn't only exist in running, victory exists in sports, period. And we can go, if we're about victory, we don't have to remain in running shoes. We can expand to other categories alongside. So so part of it is like that is the groundwork. But then at the same time, when they're going to start to go into golf and basketball and lots of other sports, and now they're in wearables and apparel. They're way beyond shoes. They have to add other pillars at the bottom of the ladder. They can't only be about fast. They have to add other reasons to believe, other proof points that uphold this bigger promise. So if we're going to bring a bigger promise to the world, we have to have more proof points to enable that. So then they add, lightweight fabrics and, you know, high-tech sweat-proof. I'm making this up. I don't even know what they would put at the bottom of the ladder, but it's something about the sensory experience and the frictionlessness quality that enables you to perform really well in a sport. So you can't just claim a bigger space on the ladder until you've earned it, and you've earned it by delivering your original promise really well, but you've also been innovating to make that a more and more expansive idea that can live in other categories as well. So otherwise it's like, you're making a big promise without backing it up with reasons to believe, and that erodes trust.
Got it. Wow. Okay. So I would consider what we've done here today something of a brand masterclass.
Okay.
I'm not good about it. All right. Well, is there anything that I didn't ask you about brand? Because your book has a lot in it. And, you know, like I said, I haven't gotten through all of it, but what I did get through gave me enough to go this full hour and 40 minutes of us talking about brand. But is there anything else you think people really need to know, something that I didn't ask about related to brand, that's going to help people walk away from this episode and go and do something remarkable tomorrow, aside from going on Amazon.com and purchasing your book directly to their Kindle or coming in paperback or hardcover form?
Thanks for that, Jeff. I think that, you know, the thing about brand that is now getting a lot more conversation than it used to have is the idea of using brand as a way to create meaning for employees and galvanizing employees, as well as attracting the right customer. So in a world where employees are more and more looking for that sense of purpose and for, like, why do we exist outside of the P&L that we're hopefully growing, again, like, it, that can be sort of this mystical, squishy thing to define that. And brand can be your friend when it comes to the North Star for the internal brand builders, as well as for the customer. So that's when brand really starts to become this this flywheel of value creation, is because then your employees are also attracted to your company. Because they resonate with the company's purpose. And then those employees in turn create more value for the customers who are also craving that. So think of it as just this overarching crystallization of purpose that can motivate and manifest all the reasons that your company exists to begin with.
Love it. I'm glad you added that, because I think so often in the conversation for business, and this isn't just, you know, when we're talking about brands, really when we're talking about anything, we get very obsessed with the customer. And I was on a podcast with a good friend of mine who's another podcaster, Doug Sandler. He has a podcast called The Nice Guys on Business. Great podcast. But he asks this question where he says, rank the following. And he says, products, services, employees, customers. I think that's what the four were. I might be messing up products and services. They might be one and the same, and there's another one. But anywho, it's very rare for us to talk about employees. And I think that that's such a mistake, because this overwhelming focus on the customer, I think too many businesses forget that the way you treat your employees is going to be the way that they treat their customers. And they're such a vital part of that. And beyond that, the employees are, in their own right now in 2019 and beyond, they are their own marketing channels for the business. What they write on Glassdoor matters. What they write on their Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn about their work matters. And without a cohesive message that helps to drive them moving all in the same direction, you're not going to attract more of the people who resonate with that vision. You're not going to be able to keep those people because there's somebody else who's going to come along willing to pay them more money or maybe give them something to believe in. So I'm really glad that you brought that up. And I think that it's a conversation that needs to happen more, especially as it relates to brand and how that is a way of galvanizing those employees and keeping them moving in the same direction.
Yes, 1,000%. Boom, you said it perfectly.
Man, this was a blast. I'm so glad that you came on and that you know, we were able to connect and I got a chance to look at your book and everything. I think you're doing really great work out there. And you know, I think hopefully people that have listened to this episode get a lot out of it and are inspired to really think about their own brand. I have one final question.
Okay.
Before we go. Can you build a brand after the brand's already been built, or do you have to do this starting from scratch?
You can build it after it's already been built. It's nice when you don't have a lot of baggage. It's nice to be able to have kind of a blank slate, but the vast majority of businesses that I work with already have, you know, they already have a brand name. They already have customers. They just haven't like sharpened their pencil to get it super dialed in. So yeah, absolutely. You can do this and you can take an old and sick brand, and you can improve it drastically just by getting really deliberate about why you exist and who you serve.
So it's not squishy, elusive, or superficial or intangible, but it is malleable.
Exactly. It absolutely is like platinum.
Got it. All right. Well, this is the chance in your show. I want you to tell people where they can go and be social with you, where they can learn about you, where they can pick up your book, where they can hire you, where they can just send you postcards that tell you how great you are. Whatever it is that you want to share, this is the point in the show where it's completely turned over to you and you can promote yourself unabashedly.
Oh, thank you so much, Jeff. This has just been such a pleasure to talk to you about brand for this luxuriously long space. So thank you. And to listeners, yeah, so my book is Forging an Ironclad Brand. It's available on Amazon, IndieBound, all those sorts of places. And if listeners are interested, I do have a free giveaway that's sort of a supplement to the book. It's a workbook of the step-by-step method we talked about in this podcast that can kind of accompany you as you're reading the book and you're going through the steps. So you can find that at ironcladbrandstrategy.com. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn and would love to know folks who are listening to this. So reach out to me on LinkedIn and Twitter as well. And yeah, I just encourage you to think about brand in as big of a way as you can so that it can, you know, create the most sense of purpose for your business.
Rockin'. Well, take it from me. The book is fantastic. The book is ironclad. And this podcast was shareable.
Wait, don't leave. If you've never listened to my fancy outro, do it just once for me, please. Okay, if you enjoy shareable and you find it valuable, there's a few ways that you can support the show. One, you can share it on social media, which I strongly encourage. I mean, it's literally the name of the show. Shareable. Two, you can review it on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're an Overcast user, as many of my listeners are, make sure to click that star button on the episodes that you like. The third way that you can support the show is by blogging about it or discussing it on your own podcast, or even by making a YouTube video where you talk about one of the episodes. And then the final way that you can support the show is by supporting it directly on Patreon. You can find the link in the show notes. Now, before I let you go, I want to tell you about one other thing, shareable.fm, where this podcast is hosted. Do you have a podcast or know someone that has a podcast that you think is particularly, I don't know, shareable? Well, send them to shareable.fm to apply to be on the network. Shows that are selected not only get added to the site, and in some cases to the Shareable FM radio podcast, but we also bring together the best tips, tricks, and tactics for promoting your show and growing listenership. And for our headliner and feature shows, we provide fully outsourced social advertising support. So leave the promotion to us, okay? So give it a look, and if you want to find some new and interesting shows, or if you just want additional exposure for your own show or know someone who would benefit, please let them know about it.
Thank you for tuning into another episode of Shareable. I sincerely appreciate it. And this show would mean absolutely nothing without you, the listener. So thank you. And I hope to see you back for the next one. Goodbye for now.